You're listening to El Niños, the Tornado Hunters Podcast. Grab a cerveza and turn up those speakers.
Yawn, man! Whoa!
Good driving, Ricky.
Oh, this vehicle's underneath it.
Oh! It's
taking up power poles.
Welcome to El Niños, the Tornado Hunters Podcast. On this episode, we welcome our special guest, Tommy Chong, actor, comedian, ex-con, dancer, husband, father, activist, and overall connoisseur of cannabis. We'll also find out how Nick the Body found a love of storm chasing, and Chris will share with us his weather history moment. El Niños, the Tornado Hunters Podcast, is part of the Stormfront Freaks Podcast Network. Hit the like or subscribe button and get notifications whenever new podcasts are posted. Also, I'd like to give a shout out to some of our newest Patreon members. We've got Jens, Corey, Kiefer, and Kevin, all new to the Patreon page. And if you would like to join our Patreon page, head over to patreon.com/El Niños and you can join the team. Patreon members get early access to new content. They get to meet our celebrity guests, like when we have awesome guests like Tommy Chong on. We have a monthly happy hour event and so much more. Go to patreon.com/El Niños. So now let's meet the Niños. First up, we've got Ricky Forbes. Ricky, you're tuning in from home in Saskatoon. How are things right now?
Yeah, it's good. Beautiful Monday. Feeling good. That's about it, Greggles.
Hey, what do you think of this, everything getting opened up here in the next few weeks?
Oh, you know, it's incredible. It feels like you're getting freedom again, like a weight off your shoulders. I just can't wait to enjoy life and get things back to normal.
Yeah. If anybody knows how that feels, it's our guest, Tommy Chong, right?
Yeah.
It's like getting out of prison, this whole COVID thing.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. You know, when I got out of prison, one of the reporters asked me, you know, what's prison like? And I said, well, you'll find out. And I had no idea that I was being like a prophet because the whole world found out what it's like being in prison.
Yeah.
No kidding. Hey, Nick the Body, how about you? You're taking a bit of time off work today to be with us. How are things with you?
Pretty fair. I'm just looking forward to some heat coming our way here in the prairies, although it's going to get a little crazy. I think next week we're going to have to crank up those ACs. Some of the models show that it could get up to like 40 degrees Celsius in southwestern Saskatchewan, southeastern Alberta, that area, and then like Montana and Idaho are just going to be on fire, it looks like. So
yeah, they're gonna be right up there with California with those kinds of temperatures. And it'll be an interesting summer, I think, this year. It'll be one of those ones where we're either going to be suffering through what I went through last night, which was mosquitoes. I don't know if you guys are getting them where you are too, but holy smokes, the mosquitoes were bad. Or we're going to have this like crazy hot temperatures, and hopefully we'll have a nice balance between them. Chris, how about you? We got Cubby. Chris Chittick is here. Cubby, how are you doing Monday on a Monday morning?
Doing good. Great weekend. You know, spent the weekend with the family, and super excited actually, because this week is going to be my last week of doing school talks. So I'm ready for a much needed break from school talks. You know, I've been doing two a day, so it's take the next like 4 or 6 weeks off and just kind of chill out and have a good summer.
Right on. And how's baby doing?
Oh, baby's doing great. She's 2.5 months old now. So
No. I was talking about your wife, Chelsea. How's your baby doing?
Yeah, no, she's doing great. She's a great mom, you know, great wife, and some fun to hang out with.
Hey, this whole Father's Day thing probably takes on a new thing for you now with three kids, eh? Father's Day.
Yes, but you know what was true is like yesterday, it was my day. So I just like did some yard work in the morning, mowed the grass, and then sat and watched golf the whole rest of the day.
Do you know who their dads are?
It's not the milkman, I can tell you that.
That sounds like, honest to be honest, that sounds like every day. Like, what's the difference between what happened yesterday and normal?
Yeah, no, it gets crazy in my household here, Nick. Okay. Crazy.
I believe you.
I kind of want to have you over for a day just to experience it.
So what year at school do you teach?
Oh, no. So I'm just I do hour-long presentations to students from grades 1 all the way up to 12, talking about extreme weather and, like, the science behind it, you know, like safety, education, the whole bit. So it's good because it's in all the curriculum up here in Canada and a lot in states as well. So just keeping busy, but speaking twice a day, it's killing me. I need a little bit of a break.
Yeah, running your mouth is hard for a Canadian, I guess.
I hear you.
Well, listen, yeah. I want to thank you guys all for joining us today. And for everyone who's tuning in, listening from around planet Earth, reminder that we can be found on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok. Also visit us at tornadohunter.com, and you can get past episodes of El Niño's The Tornado Hunters podcast. So let's get right into this with our special guest, Tommy Chong. Probably needs no introduction, but I'm going to give him a short one anyway. Tommy, along with partner Cheech Marin, made a career out of smoking weed. And there's a lot of kids probably around North America that are like, really, I can make a living doing that? Well, here's a guy living the dream, Tommy Chong. You are a dancer, a husband, you've got kids, you're activist, comedian, and you've traveled the world. What label out of all of those most resonates for you?
God, I don't know. Ex-con, I guess. That's the one I always bring up, because no matter where I'm at, usually, you know, at some dinner party, you know, with some of my Trumpy friends, you know, I managed to, or someone managed to bring up the fact that I was in jail. And the funny thing is that these guys are rich enough so that everybody's got some relative or someone they knew that was also in jail. So I guess that ex-con, I love that introduction when you said it. It was very funny.
Listen, Tommy, I got to ask you, though, about that. Yeah. Because if it was 2021, you wouldn't have been going to jail for what you went to jail for.
Unless, like, I was black. Like, you know, if I was black, I would be definitely in jail. I'd still be in jail, you know. You're right. We're making gains. But you know what I come to realize is that it's all about money, you know. I mean, the reason pot was illegal for so long is that it created such a windfall for everybody. And the only penalty was like jail time. And but other than that, you know, like weed was selling when they legalized, it was selling at $3,000 a pound. It's down to $800 a pound now. So and it's dropping. It's going to drop even more. And not only that, but it's being recorded. So all the sales, you know exactly who's getting what and how much money's coming in. See, back in the day when it was illegal, everybody collected except the poor guy that got caught every once in a while. And even he was okay because there was so much money being made. You know, the cartels, look at what the cartels, they found out, you know, they were into the billions of dollars, you know, because it's tax-free money, you see. And so what I'm finding out, it wasn't political, you know, or even health reasons. It was the black market money that everybody, including all the especially the governments in South America, you know, they're all corrupt. Mexico's corrupt to the point where, you know, when you get pulled over by a Mexican cop, you're actually paying his salary. You know, he's stopping you for his money. Mm-hmm. And when they legalized it, like in America, you know, all that went away. And so you know, societies has to adjust to being going from gangsters to being honest. So my eyes have been opened incredibly the last, you know, since it's been legal. Because you think, well, it's legal, so, you know, everything's okay now. But no, it's not legally federally yet. And so the pot people that are in the pot business, we can't take off expenses for our business. We can't bank our money in the banks yet. We can't use credit cards. You know, we're still considered like an outlaw business. And so that has to change. But what really got affected was the black market money that, you know, there were like drug agents, DEA, that had two houses, you know, a summer house and a boat. You know, on a cop salary, you know. Well, those guys have to either, you know, retire. A lot of them have retired and got into the pot business. So you know, my eyes are opening up so big now because I see why it is still illegal, you know, federally.
Yeah, I always find it interesting. Like, I'm a big fan of watching those shows on like Netflix, like Narcos and stuff.
Yeah,
just to see like the government interaction and like the way things really were. I mean, it's obviously it's a show, but it's still some realism to it, you know. And like, yeah. I love watching those shows. Behind, you know, Tornado Hunters is probably my top favorite. But
yeah, well, that's
those ones are good as well.
Yeah,
that explains the migration. You know, where everybody wants to come out of Guatemala. Figure out, like, you know, people say, you know, the migration, they got to stand in line and do everything legal. But I think walking on foot, carrying a baby 1,300 miles is sort of like an indication that you want to get out of where you were and you want to get into something safe.
Slightly, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that sort of like is a good test of character, if nothing else, you know. And so now we're coming around because we got you know, the ex-president on the ropes now. And by the way, if you're watching this, you know, people are getting mad at the Dems because they're not moving fast enough, but they're moving slow enough to make sure that all this crap that Trump started will be there when we have to elect representatives and, you know, midterms election. And so I predict that we're going to be all Democratic, and the Republicans that are left are going to be like Democrats. You know, they'll come to their senses. But right now, you know, as we can see and watching the news, man, can you imagine our forefathers that wrote the Constitution, if they were here thinking about an ex-president that started an insurrection that had people killed, and it was all photographed. That's what cracks me up. I laugh at that more than anything. They were all confessing on camera, taking selfies of themselves, committing a crime that could put them in jail for 20, 30 years. I mean, it's crazy.
Mind-blowing.
Yeah, mind-blowing. But I'm really enjoying my life now because it's so exciting. And the lockdown, I love it. I love it.
So what do you love about the lockdown, Tommy?
I'm living in a multi-million dollar home in the Palisades. Awesome. I don't even get on the phone. My wife gets on the phone, orders the food and whatever comforts we need. It's delivered. I don't have to go shop, stand in line, or park a car. I'm here. This is what this is my job is talking on the phone. That's my job. I make more money doing cameos than I ever did on the road with Teach. You know, no expenses. I mean, it's incredible.
what a time to be alive. What a time to be alive.
And then you don't have to be around people, you know.
That's the best.
And the only people I'm around are people like big fans, like all the construction workers and the people that deliver the stuff and that. And my job really is taking pictures. Oh, there's John. Okay, we take a picture? Sure. You know, and then I get compliments. They say, you're so nice. Of course I'm nice. Can you imagine? I mean, getting paid. I mean, all the years when Cheech and I first made it, we were on the road so much that we never got a chance to watch the fruit trees, to enjoy the fruit off the trees that are growing in our garden. You know, all the help, they were enjoying it, you know. Like George Lopez once said, you know, he went to his house being reconstructed and the workers were in the pool. And they said, hey, come on in the pool, man. It's really nice when the boss is away. You know, and it was George. and like you said, I don't know, someone said that, like Father's Day. I had the best Father's Day because I got my own office. I got my own television set. And actually, I got my own bedroom, too, with a TV in it. I got every channel in the world that I can. I'm just finding out, learning how to do it. And what I did yesterday, Father's Day, golf all day. I mean, and without guilt. Because
it was a hell of a match, wasn't it?
Wasn't it? And, you know, my buddy, the guy I was in jail with, he's a caddy for Harris English.
Oh, wow.
And he came in third, man.
Yeah.
And he was quietly. They never photographed him at all. You know, he wasn't on camera at all. One time he made a birdie on 18. But he was even. And then one below par. And then he ended up finishing in the clubhouse with a 68, 3 under par. Yeah, and then I watched everybody fall apart, like Shambo. Oh man, that was sad when he fell apart, man. Oh,
yeah, he got that double bogey and then it was just straight downhill after that one.
Oh, I felt so bad for him. And you can see in his swing too, because he got angry and you saw that swing that he did and he lost his balance and oh man, he lost his cool. But John Rahm that won, and then I loved his spiritual talk. Wasn't that cool?
Yeah,
cool. He said it was karma. It was ordained. And he felt that higher power. He felt that higher power. I still maintain that golf is the world religion, that we all adhere to the same rules all around the world. And you keep your own score. And it's golf is so cool. Yeah, so that's my life, man. So, like, I got a little putting thing out here. And when I get tired of sitting and watching TV, I get up and go practice my putting and my swings and my man. I can't be happier.
So that's the secret to life, then, is it? Living a long life is golf.
It's part of it. Part of it, because think about it. You walk. You know, you're not allowed to ride, you know, if you're a pro. You have to not only be physical, but you have to have your mental state together. Like Tiger, for instance. When Tiger was unbeatable, it was because of his Tibetan where's she from? His wife, his mother from Thailand.
He's Philippines, isn't he?
No, I think it's Thai. I think it's Thai. Well, anyway, she's a Buddhist or whatever, you know, and she taught him mind control, and not mind control, but controlling through the spiritual, you know, the getting spiritual. And so Tiger would get into that zone, but he was pure, and you know, and like the Bible says that, don't bring a prayer to me if you still got something against your brother. you know. And so a lot of people take that as, you know, just what it says. But the truth is that if you got any impure thoughts in your mind, you can't have two thoughts in the same time in your mind. And so as long as you've got pure thoughts in your mind, you will succeed, because the forces will make you succeed, because they will answer every prayer that you have. But if you got, you know, like if your aim is for something else other than, you know, just pure being close to God, then that doesn't work. You see, because you can't fool God. You know, he's too smart.
So, we're trying to teach Ricky that too. Like, just be pure and just focus.
It's hard. That's very hard to do. You know, because we're human creatures that we're here to learn, and you know, that's why we're in the physical world. We're learning all the time. But when you hit that line, you know, it's like a pure note on a piano or a violin or something, that pure note. And when you're in that zone, like Tiger was for years, look how many years he was on top. You know? Mm-hmm. And then when he fell off because Michael Jordan and Charles Barkley showed him that he had a
right there.
and that was the end of that.
didn't they take him like to Vegas or something, and then he just went nuts after that point?
That's right. And we found out that, you know, how much power he had, and so he was schlepping everything in sight. The waitress, the bellhop, anything to come near him. And then he wasn't nice. You see,
that's what happened.
You got to be human. You got to be nice. You got to be thankful. See, if you're not thankful, then bad things happen. Yeah.
Sense of entitlement, right, Tommy? Like, you know, there's that phenomenon in psychology, the cognitive dissonance, and you've gotten your fill of that in the United States, where you've got these people who, you know, are bending over backwards to say, like you talked about, the insurrection. Well, that never happened, or this, it was these people, and they're bending over backwards to try and reconcile their need to try and be good and reason through that in an unreasonable manner. And they end up corrupted, right? And that's, I think it's exactly what happened to Tiger, is that he just became, you know, he lost everything because he couldn't reconcile those things anymore, right? What he'd been taught. And
And the bad things are still happening to him.
Yep.
I mean, can you imagine? He was driving down the road and the car tipped over, it crashed.
And the wonderful thing about it is that we all like a comeback story too, right? And so everybody, I think, who has that sort of, like you do, you're very comfortable in who you are, and it probably took you a long time to get to that point, but we're all people who are like that are really rooting for these people, even though they're like, well, you kind of get what you deserve, but who wouldn't want to see Tiger come back and be the person he was, right? And so that's that part of that human spirit where we're all like connected in some way, and we want to see each other do good, but we know, like, oh my God, like these people need to get over this, or, you know, move through it, grow up.
Well, speaking of coming back and growing up, we're going to be coming back with Tommy Chong and more of his story right after this break. El Niños, the Tornado Hunters podcast, is brought to you by CameraEasy.ca. Anyone can take great photos. I know, because I've taught thousands of people how to use their fancy digital cameras. I make it simple and easy to understand so that even a pure beginner can get the most out of their camera. So if you want better pictures starting today, check out CameraEasy.ca. Now it's time for the Camera Easy 30 Seconds to Better Photos. Here is my tip of the week. Stop putting your subject right in the middle of the frame. Now, sometimes it works, but a lot of times the subject doesn't need to be actually in the middle of the shot. You can have the subject moved out to the outside edges of the photo. We call it the rule of thirds, and a quick Google search and you'll find lots of information about the rule of thirds, but the basic idea is that when we put the subject right in the middle of the frame, a lot of times it looks kind of amateur, but by putting the subject out towards the edge of the frames or out to the third lines, it's a little bit more interesting to look at, and your viewer has to engage with the photo. That's my tip of the week.
This is Weather History with Chris Chittick. June 17, 2009, Central Nebraska tornadoes. All parameters pointed to the Triple Point boundary in Central Nebraska.
Tornado! Oh!
By late afternoon, an intense tornadic supercell developed and tracked eastward through Grand Island and Aurora. A tornado emergency was later declared for Aurora, Nebraska, as a large tornado was approaching town. The tornado downed power lines, nearly destroying a dog food factory as it passed very close to the structure, and damaged several homes before dissipating.
We gotta go, we gotta go, we gotta go!
I witnessed a half dozen tornadoes this day. Severe damage was reported in a rural community about 5 miles west of Aurora. The tornado was estimated to be a quarter mile wide as it was on the ground for about 18 minutes. The tornado was rated EF2 on the Enhanced Fujita scale and had a track length of 5 miles.
All right, we're back with our guest, Tommy Chong. Tommy, were you respected in jail?
Are you kidding? I was a big fan. In fact, it got almost too much to the fact where the first day I was in jail, I spent most of my time taking pictures with everybody. And I was outside. I kind of wanted to take in the scenery because the sunset was incredible. And the clouds were just beautiful, you know, red clouds, and we're in the desert, you know, and so the sky can really put on a show for you. In fact, while I was there, I started a movement of watching the sunset every night, every evening, and I would watch it for a few days, and then I realized it's 2 weeks. I've watched every sunset for 2 weeks, and then it got to the point where people were joining me. At the end, we watched every sunset for 3 months, every sunset. And then there are people that knew I was in there, like skydivers. And I found out later, because part of the show would be these skydivers would come out in the evening and do these skydiving things. And so we're not only watching the sunset, we're watching a show, an aerial show. And then I found out later that the skydivers knew that I was there. And so they were putting on a show for me. So, I was like, in fact, even the warden, it cracked me up. I met, like, there's two prisons. I was in the camp behind the real prison. And the real prison was hardcore, mostly Spanish. And there's like 2,000 people in there. And in the camp, there's only 400 of us. And we're divided up into the gay side and the straight side. And 200 on either side. And we had dormitory. They built it, Taft, as a woman's prison first, but they never had enough females to populate it. So they decided to turn it into like a celebrity camp more than anything. And so in order to start the prison, see, the people that work in the prisons, for the most part, it's a job that they could do because they're not really that qualified to do too much else, you know, and they're living in the country anyway. And so it's either a job at Burger King or in the prison. And so the personnel at the prison, they're not the brightest tool in the shop. The people that are in the prisons, lawyers and doctors and all sorts of intelligent people, they actually ran the prison. And so when they opened the woman's prison, and when they turned it into like a camp, they weren't organized, and so they had to ship prisoners from other prisons. They had to find the nonviolent types, you know, and so they filled up the bus. But because they're prisoners, they had to shackle them, and then they had one big old Mexican. They couldn't find any shackles that go around his feet, so they had to hog tie him with a rope. And so then they had to drive the school bus full of prisoners from the other prison to Taft. And it took, you know, about 50 miles or so. And they got stopped by the highway patrol. This is a prison. And the highway patrol gave them a ticket because you weren't supposed to transport dangerous prisoners in a school bus. And so they got a ticket for that.
Oh, geez.
And when they finally got there, the warden had arranged a band to play music while the prisoners disembarked. But on the way there, one of the prisoners, the guy that was shackled with a rope, they couldn't let him out to do a pee break. And so he sort of soiled his drawers while he was driving out there. And the smell was horrible, but they're prisoners. They couldn't do anything about it. And so when they got to Taft, the band starts playing. The mayor comes up to welcome the guy. The door is open. This guy comes out first because they kicked his out first. And the stench came out and it hit the crowd. The band quit playing. Everybody just scattered.
So you're in jail for 3 months, was it?
Well, that was the beginning of the thing. And then the prisoners went into the women's prison because there was no real guards or anybody. There was no organization. And so the smart prisoners right away, they went and got the best cells or the cubicles. And then they ordered, there was no food, nothing stuff, you know, for prisoners. And so the prisoners themselves, they ordered stuff, and they ordered things like barbecue pits. they had their own barbecue stand. It was incredible. It was like a summer away thing. And then they never had the count either. And so, there was no gate around it. And so these prisoners would go, they would leave for the weekend and go spend the weekend with their wives or the girlfriends in a motel nearby. And then they would walk back to the prison. I mean, it was crazy. It was so crazy. And then, oh God, there's so many stories of it. But the warden, anyway, the warden was very, you know, because, you know, I was like an international movie star. And so the warden wanted to meet me. And I met him and he shook my hand. He was like a big fan. And so I was doing a documentary at the time. And so they... So the guy shooting the documentary, a really good friend of mine, Josh Gilbert, since then he passed away, but he was one of these, you know, LA kind of guys that could get anything he wanted. So he found out where the warden lived and where he had breakfast. So he would go have breakfast with the warden a couple of days, and then he got to be friends with him. And so he got permission to shoot his documentary inside the prison, inside the warden's office. And so I'm in there doing a documentary. You know, I'm supposed to be in prison. I'm in the prison garb and everything. And because it's a movie being shot, you know, movies, you know, they got all the control in the world. And so just for fun, I yelled out, I said, "Quiet, we're shooting a documentary in here." And so I had the warden tiptoeing around. I had everybody just being really quiet, like on a movie set. I tell you, I can't tell you how much fun I had. When I was on Dancing with the Stars, we had to do a my favorite year. And so I picked prison as my favorite year because I had so much fun. And then I wrote a book about it. So, oh my God, it was incredible. You know, and I ended up in the same cubicle as Jordan Belfort, you know, the Wolf of Wall Street. And that's another whole story that went viral, actually. You know, and it showed you the weakness and the strength of our system, because what happens, like when you get, we've got laws now that when you're put in prison, you have to, if you don't have a high school education, you have to go to school. And so there's a lot of immigrants that learn their English and their trade and everything else from being in American prisons. And that's one of the good things. You know, and the prison system itself, they're stronger than the courts even. There are people, when I was there, that were supposed to be released, but because the prison needed them or wanted them, they just ignored the request. And these people, you know, they stayed in prison. It's like, you know, you're being tortured every day in prison and you're being beat up and all that. That doesn't happen, you know. You're being protected, if nothing else, you know. And all that other gang stuff and that, you know, yeah, it happens amongst themselves more than anybody else, you know. But if you mind your own business and if you don't make eye contact with anybody, you can practically do anything, you know, that you've done on the outside, except you're not on the outside, you're on the inside.
Tommy, how old are you?
I'm 83.
83.
Made you three. Yep.
Here, let me date you a little bit more then. Are you okay with that?
Sure.
So do you remember being on tour in the UK back in the early 70s?
Oh yeah.
So my mother and father,
they
saw you on tour in the UK.
Where
back? And my mom thinks it was 71. Does that sound about right?
Yep. That sounds perfect.
Yeah. So I would have been a toddler, and they probably would have paid somebody to watch me while they went to your show.
And what town? Because we did the whole tour.
I think she said Royal Albert Hall. Is that possible?
Yes. 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 Yeah. We were there. Yeah. We were there.
Yeah. Well, that my mother was in the audience, and she still talks about that show.
Oh, that tour was so funny because we were hot. We were so hot then. And Peter Sellers was the one that booked the tour. He was
the Pink Panther.
That's right. He was such a big fan that he actually arranged the tour, because Peter was a offspring of Bud Billions. And Peter himself at one time, he was booked as the world's greatest jazz drummer in the UK. And he toured around the country when he was like a teenager as the world's greatest drummer. Then he eventually became an actor, and then Peter Sellers, a great comedian. But he loved our act so much that he arranged the tour. And let me tell you how he met us at the airport. We're on the British airplane, and, you know, Airways, and they landed. And then the stewardess come up to us, you know, our group, and said, okay, you let everybody off the plane, and then you guys are going to go somewhere else. Once you get off the plane, you just follow me. And so everybody got off the plane. Then we got off the plane. We followed the stewardess, and she led us to this little courtyard. In the courtyard was a big white limousine. And as we approached the limousine, the window rolled down, and this hand came out of the window holding the biggest block of hash I've ever seen. And the hash was burning. It was lit. And that was our greeting from Peter Sellers. So Teach and I got in the car with our wives, and we had a nice little big hit of hash, and oh God. And that was just the beginning of the tour. And then one time we're in the middle of the tour, and they booked us everywhere. They booked us in a Catholic girls' school. and we started our act, and next thing you know, it was like a fire drill. The nuns got up first, and then the rest of the girls, and they all filed out like it was a fire drill.
Wait a second. Who booked you two at a Catholic girls' school. Was that Peter Sellers?
Peter Sellers, yeah. Well, his, you know, they had, what do you call, agencies, you know, booking agencies. And, you know, they had no idea, you know, these are comedians, you know. It still happens here. Like, we were teaching, I got booked at a Warburton golf tournament, you know, with all these Republicans and all these straight people. And they, because we'd play golf, both Cheech and I played golf. And so they, but what they do, they try to get, you know, some blood out of a stone. You know, if you're a celebrity, they try to get you on the stage and do your act and all that stuff, you know, but we're not housebroken at all. You know? So we're in this Catholic girls' school, and they, before we even, we just started, hey, how are you? And next thing you know, they're up and they're leaving. And I said, hey, don't go now. You're going to miss that part where I. And that kind of hurried them up a little bit.
That's hilarious.
We had the best time. And then we played at Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club. Because Cheech and I, we told Peter, you know, we like, you know, little clubs, you know, because we started in clubs, and jazz clubs are perfect. And so Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club, but it's English. And so we did one show, and then we're about to go in to do the second show, and Ronnie Scott himself comes up, and he says, "Here, boys, here's 50 quid. Don't do the doggy bit, okay?" England was always good to me, though. Before I met Cheech, I was over there with Motown playing a little club. Well, we were back in, they booked us in a little club called the Speakeasy. And so we were playing away, and there's nobody in the club. You know, it was empty. And all of a sudden, the door opened, and in walks Jimi Hendrix. And he comes walking in, and he's being followed by about 300 people. You know, it's like a Pied Piper. And he's all had the robes, you know, and the scarves and the wild clothes and everything else. And he walked up to the stage and he called me by name. He knew me because he knew the band. We're from Vancouver. And Jimmy used, when he was stationed in Whidbey Island, he would come up and come to our after hours club when he was just, you know, before he became Jimi Hendrix. And Jimmy James, I think his name was. So he recognized me. And he said, "Do you mind if I sit in?" And of course, you know, I was so tempted to say, "Oh, well, maybe our last set, Jimmy."
Yeah.
"We got a lot. We got a lot of tunes. We got to work out first." but of course, I took off my guitar and I handed it to Jimmy, and he's a left-handed guitar player. So he says, "No, let me play the bass. I'll play bass." And so I put my guitar back on. Eddie Patterson, the other guitar player from Canada, he put his. He's all happy. Wes Henderson, our bass player, he was so sad because Jimmy took his bass and then he played. And we must have played for hours. Anyway, they pulled the plug on us. And the owner, finally, because we were just having a great time. And then we went back to our hotel. And that's when I found out how crazy popular Hendrix was, because the fans, the girls, were literally crawling up the elevator shaft to get to our room to get to Jimi Hendrix. It was crazy. And Jimmy himself, we went into our room and he headed straight for the bathroom and stayed there the entire night by himself, you know, shooting up whatever drugs he was doing at the time. None of us were heroin addicts. We were just potheads. And so we're out in the front, up in the main room, smoking pot, saying, "Hey, Jimi Hendrix is in the bathroom, man." You believe that? I've had some pretty good memories.
So what about Canada? You are Canadian by birth.
Yes, I am. I am. I was born in Edmonton, eh?
And then you lived in Vancouver. You had a club in Vancouver.
Yep.
And how did that come about? How did that come about?
My whole life has been special, very, very ordained. And we got to the club. Well, first of all, we got kicked out of Calgary because we were so popular. For some reason, I started a teen club in Calgary. And because it was a teen club, we got special attention from the Legion, the Canadian Legion. They liked the fact that we had a teen club. And so they gave us a dance hall, beautiful, beautiful dance venue. And that's where we started our rhythm and blues, first rhythm and blues band in Western Canada. The other one was Ronnie Hawks and the Hawkins, but they were from the States, but they were playing in Canada, in the East Coast. And so I had the first rhythm and blues band, mostly black. In fact, toward the end, we were all black except me. And the mayor, the racist mayor in Calgary, and the chief of police, they really did not like the fact that we were so popular that we would attract all these kids from all over Alberta would come to the dance. But they made us quit at midnight because of the Alberta liquor laws, you know. And even, yeah, and it was, yeah, the Legion Hall, you know, served booze, not to our dance people, but, you know, they served booze, and so they had to kick us out at 12 midnight. But when they did that, they had like 300 people, teenagers with nothing to nowhere to go in Calgary. And so they went around the city, you know, causing all sorts of havoc, you know, like rock and roll people would do. And so the mayor had us come, the chief of police and the mayor and everybody was, and they called us in. And I thought we were going to get some kind of award, you know, for being such a good teenager, a teen club. And instead they gave us, they told us to get out of town. And so we headed to Vancouver. That's how we ended up in Vancouver. Now, how we got the clubs was pretty cool because our band, again, was, you know, real popular. And we played around Vancouver, you know, every place we could play, mostly in Chinatown at a little club called the New Delhi. And then this one fan of ours bought a building. And in the building on the west side, which was very nice, he had a steakhouse that was empty. And so he came up with this idea. He said, why don't you guys start a nightclub, after-hours nightclub? And so we did. And we did rent-free for a lot of months. It took us about 3-4 months to get it off the ground and get it running. In fact, at one time, I was ready to sell, give half of the club away for $100 so I could do some advertising because we were so broke, you know, because we had no other jobs except our music and we weren't making any money in the club. So we had to do side gigs. But anyway, it caught on and it became the most popular club on the West Coast. And that's where Hendrix would come up and see us and all the, and that's where the Supremes with Diana Ross saw us. And she phoned Barry Gordy and Barry Gordy flew into Vancouver to see Diane, actually. But he saw us, he signed us, and then he forgot about us. And we played our way across the country to Detroit. And then we did a hit record that I wrote called Does Your Mama Know About Me? And that's how we became famous at Motown. And then I got fired from Motown because I had to get a green card because most of us were Canadians. Oh, by the time we went to our black guys who were American, when we got signed with Motown, everybody celebrated. Hey, we got signed with Motown. So they went down to tell their people in the States that they were with Motown and we're on our way to making a lot of money. But they forgot that they were in Canada and they went down to the States. And when they were coming back, they wouldn't let them in the country because they never had any work permits or anything else. And then so we had to replace them with white guys, really good musicians, all Canadian though. And so here we are. Now we go down to Detroit and we're in Detroit and the Canadians go home to celebrate and they couldn't get back into the States. And so I had to get a green card. You know, I was the only one that knew that we had to get a green card or was even interested. And so I got my green card. But in the meantime, they had separated Bobby Taylor. They took Bobby, went solo, as you know, they do that all the time. And so I was backing up Chris Clark, Barry Gordy's girlfriend. And so I went to get my green card, and the road manager at the time, he told me, I told him I had to go get my green card, and I took Wes with me, the bass player, and he told me I'd be fired if I left. And I used to own everything, own the band, own the club. You're going to fire me? And I didn't pay any attention to it. But sure enough, as soon as I did the meeting for the green card, Motown told me in Detroit that I was fired. But I had my girlfriend and my amp and my instruments at the club. So I had to come back, and that's when I got, the band could have saved me. The band could have said, well, if he's fired, then we're all fired, and then that would have been the end of that. But none of them did. And thank God they didn't. Because had they done, I'd still be, a Motown slave. But instead, I ended up leaving Motown and finding Cheech and becoming very famous.
Didn't you go back and get that white hat in Calgary, too, in the end?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, we did. We sure did. That's right. That's right.
I just saw a picture of you wearing one of them white hats with the red ribbon there. And I thought, wow, that's strange that you got booted out of Calgary, because that's like the most prestigious thing you can get from the city.
That's right. That's right. Well, Mayor McKay and all those people, they died. And then they got a new bunch of people. And Harris Dvorkin of Ranchmans, he was the one that arranged all that stuff, because we had a big reunion. A big band, Shades reunion at the Ranchman's Club, and then that's when he got us the white hat. I shouldn't knock it, but it wasn't a good cowboy hat. It was a cheap plastic thing made in China. So it's so typical of Calgary, though. Yeah,
but all things you've done there, Tommy. You've been in a band. You've been on, comedian. You've been on stage, movies. Everything. Like, what's your number one, what's your favorite thing that you enjoy doing the most?
Stand up was really the most fun I've ever had, doing stand up, and then having my wife join me on stage, and then having her become a stand up. And when people ask me what's the greatest thing you've ever done, is with me, is getting my wife to become a comedian. That's incredible, because you have no idea how many wives they think I'm God, and how many guys hate me, including Cheech, because I put Cheech's wife in the movie too, and because I ended up directing the movies. And so I put our wives in, but I put Cheech's wife in first, so he couldn't complain about my wife. And soon after that, they got divorced. I shouldn't laugh, but it's really funny. My wife, being a stand-up comedian really is the ultimate. Can you imagine? You walk on stage, nothing, a microphone. And then an hour later, we walk up stage and then we sell our merchandise, and it's the best.
And instant feedback, right, on whether or not you're funny and doing what you're supposed to be doing, right?
Well, you develop an attitude, and the attitude is like, well, if you don't laugh, that's your problem. I mean, I know I'm funny, and then you get fans that are, so. I mean, I got the best fans in the world by far. I mean, being on Dancing with the Stars, that's a big thing too, because my wife, she's a dancer, and she wanted to be on Dancing with the Stars. So she went to the audition, and then they found out who she was married to, and says, well, how about Tommy? Do you think he would want to be doing it? Of course, my wife is, yeah, he'll do it. And next thing I know, I've got my old ass on Dancing with the Stars, trying to keep up with these youngsters, But it's all been, my journey has been so, so much fun.
So, Tommy, let me ask you this about your journey. I mean, we're primarily listen, we're a bunch of dumb storm chasers. You know, we're trying to catch and document and tell stories about weather. You must in your travels and in your 83 years of life, you must have come across some really interesting weather phenomenon. Oh. Have you ever seen anything that you just can't explain?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I don't know where to begin. You know, like I've seen UFOs, and I've seen that. I've seen been through the LA alone. You know, been through floods, been through earthquakes. Earthquake is the weirdest thing, you know, because it can be a beautiful day out there, and all of a sudden you notice that the birds have stopped singing. It gets eerily quiet, and then all of a sudden you feel you can hear the rumble first, and then I was in the Sylmar earthquake, and it lasted a minute. Now that doesn't seem long, but when you look at your stopwatch and do a minute, and then I found out that the Alaskan earthquake lasted 10 minutes. That's eternity. And with the, and you have no idea what's going to happen because the ground's shaking, and all of a sudden the walls were shaking and slapping, and you could feel it. It builds and builds and builds and builds. And my daughter was sleeping at the time, and I pick her up, and she got really mad at me. What are you doing? And I didn't know what I was doing either, so I kind of put her back into bed, you know, and said, okay. And it was just crazy. And I've been through floods in Bel Air, you know, where there was a litter waterfall coming down the street. You know, this is in the richest areas in LA. Yeah, I've seen.
And what about the fires? I mean, the fires have really been in the news over the last couple of years in California, and this year in particular. Yeah. So have you had any close calls with the fires that have been happening in California?
Cheech, you know, is the closest that I've come to, because when he was in the middle of the Malibu fire, and he was on his roof with a hose trying to save his house and being burnt because he didn't have any shoes on, and the things were burning and all around them and that. I was pretty lucky. I've seen it, you know. I've seen the smoke and I've seen the devastation. The thing is, though, it's all nature, you know. California, well, the whole world always burned, you know. That's what they got, trees that are acclimated to the burn. They expect to burn. You know, that's how they go to seed. What it is, it's that. The climate, you know, when they say climate change and they try to take responsibility for it, it cracks me up, you know, because when you think about the climate change, this Earth has been going through climate since its beginning. And so this is just another chapter in our thing. And it's nice that humans, you know, try to take credit for it, you know. And there's things that we can do, you know, like electric cars and, you know, the windmills. And to think about it, windmills have been around for almost ever. There's always some parts of humanity that knew enough that wind can power all sorts of things. Mm-hmm.
In all your traveling across the country back and forth, did you ever see like any tornadoes or crazy storms that really stick out in your memory?
Well, you know, in my lifetime, I grew up in Calgary in the foothills out in the country there. And we used to get periodic, what they call dust storms. I don't see them anymore, but that's when the topsoil, you know, it gets blown. And you look up and it's like a sea of black. It's like a black cloud coming at you. And the only thing you could do is like hit the ground and cover your face. And just let it blow over you. You know, I've been in a few of those. When you live in the country, though, there's you learn to live with nature. There's in fact, you use nature. Part of the whole ecological thing that we go through. But there's a place in Guatemala that has almost a ring of storms around them. lightning and thunder and lightning, these certain areas on the earth that are susceptible to extreme weather. Where I lived in the prairies, you could see storm clouds. I used to lay on my back and look up at the clouds, and the clouds would be racing over the mountains. And they looked like a show going on, you know. And when I was in jail, you know, like watching the sunsets and that, you know, if we had a dust storm there, everybody had to stop what they were doing and go inside, because they had a thing called valley fever. And it was a wasting disease, much like the pandemic. So, yeah, I've seen in my day, I've seen it. And I've seen the drought and everything. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, here's a little dust storm that Greggles and I caught near Outlook, Saskatchewan earlier this year.
There you go.
Driving right into it. So we've been so dry here in Saskatchewan up until about the last 3 weeks, Tommy, that we actually had these topsoil removing dust storms occurring across the province in the south and actually right up to the north here. And it wasn't until about 3 weeks ago that we finally got out of sort of the fire danger, but you can see the wind and dust just swirling everywhere here. And that's just a strong downdraft wind picking that soil up and moving. I tell you what, that some lucky farmer to the east of this field is getting some brand new canola seeds for growing in his damp soil somewhere.
That's incredible. Yeah, I mean, this is our physical universe that we live in. Yeah, it's incredible. I can't, you know, I remember waiting for an electric car. In fact, I had a friend in my, we were trying to make our own electric car. We did. We never had the right batteries, but we did. That was seemed like yesterday, but now I drive a Tesla, and I'm looking at all the electric cars they got on the market now. I'm really happy about that, you know, because they're beautiful. We're here on Earth, you know. It's a learning thing, and I believe that we're eternal beings, so we'll always be back in one form or another. But the weather, it's crazy. I was in Vietnam, and I was under during the monsoon season, you know, where the rain, it just pours, and people just ignore it, you know, go about their lives, you know. Anywhere else, like I remember in Bel Air, California, we had the tropical rainstorms hit, you know, there's all sorts of problems happen, you know, but in those countries, you know, they know how to irrigate, and they know how to prepare for everything, and then they know how to use the water for energy, for everything. And China is incredible, you know, the old China, you know, where they created fish ponds and you know, created fish like goldfish, and where they would use nature to create the fertilizer and the water, and then you didn't have any cliffs falling, everything was terraced down. You look at, like, I'm watching the Himalayas and that, and they terrace everything down, so they use every inch of usable land. You know, and that's the ancients. They did that way back, way, way, way back in the day, you know. And so all that stuff that we're, you know, especially hurricanes and, you know, when the houses get ruined and that, and it's always boggled my mind that someone hasn't come up with a design, you know, like the bees, you know, when they have hives, you know, you look at a beehive, you know, it's architecturally the most incredible structure you could get. Or the termite mounds in Africa, you know, where they built these things with air conditioning and everything, you know, waste disposals and all that stuff. Yeah, we're still learning.
Tommy, you are one interesting cat, but we're going to take a quick break right there. We're going to find out a little bit more about our friend Nick the Body, and then we'll be back with Tommy Chong.
One of the questions I often get asked is, how did you get into storm chasing? And for me, the answer can be pinpointed to 1991, when I was watching a documentary on one of the cable networks at the time around storm chasing. In particular, this video of the tornado ripping through the McConnell Air Force Base in Andover, Kansas, was really what intrigued me. Seeing this monster created by Mother Nature destroying everything in its path, hearing the tornado siren cut out as the tornado knocked out the power and sirens that were going off, and then hearing the roar of the tornado as it ate up everything in its path, really made me think, this is an interesting phenomenon here, and I need to know more about this. In particular, I was very curious about the people who were filming, who sounded like they weren't sure whether or not this tornado was going to make a direct impact on them, and the fear that they had. And so I started researching weather and meteorology at that time. Certainly for a while it was a dream of mine to become a meteorologist. That dream sharply faded away when I found out what was entailed in terms of studying for meteorology. But in 1996, the movie Twister came out, and it reignited that spark that I had and an interest in chasing storms in particular. And I thought, well, this is a way that I could contribute to relaying valuable information about what's happening on the ground to those people who are issuing those very important watches and warnings that we all need to take seriously. And so from that point forward, I had decided that when I was old enough, I would certainly be getting my Environment Canada CANWARN certification, and then later I ended up doing the National Weather Service's SkyWARN certification, becoming a part of the Spotter Network. And that's how my passion for severe weather, but really weather of all types, was sort of ignited, was by watching this video as an 8-year-old in 1991. I'm very happy today to be able to participate in storm chasing, to be able to relay that information. Warning times, even in the past 30 years since this video was taken, have increased substantially for people. And that's really what it's about, is ensuring safety and allowing the public to understand that their property or lives might be in danger if they don't have a severe weather safety plan. And so that's how I ended up getting started in the world of storm chasing.
Hey, Tommy, listen, we've taken a lot of your time, and I sure do appreciate it. But before we leave you, I have one more question that I'd love to ask you. And that is, yesterday was Father's Day, and all four of us are fathers. And you've got a few extra years under your belt. I hope that's okay for me to say it that way.
Oh, sure. Sure.
What secret is there to being a father? What kind of advice would you give dudes like us about being a father?
Well, about being a human being, you know. There's been books written on how to live your life, and unfortunately, most people ignore them, or you know, they find some excuse to try to say, you know that's out of style, or they don't do that anymore. And that we're a human being, but we have the ability to love. Love is the really the fabric of the spiritual world. See, we live in a physical world now. In the physical world, for every action, there's a reaction. And so it comes right down to the for every physical world, there has to be a spiritual world. Now the most important part of us is spiritual, because that's the eternal part of us. And that's our mind. And so to be a good anything, especially a father, is that you have to be full of spirit. And to be full of spirit is to say, what is spirit? Spirit is love. And so if you fill yourself up with love, regardless of what your circumstances are, we have that ability. We have the ability, each of us, on this planet, including plants and animals, everything. We have that ability to fill ourselves up with love. And you do that by, it's a mental exercise. And that's why all the holy books and the Bibles and all that, they will tell you that love, the Beatles, all we need is love. They tell you that. Now, you fill yourself up with love, and that, what happens, that's what we are. When you feel, that's what priests are, and that's what holy people are. They're just so full of love. And when you have love, then there's no judgment. You're not judging anything, because you don't have to. Because when you fill yourself up with love, that alone is all you need to do. And so no matter what your circumstances are with your kids, like if you're trying to teach them or they're trying to, or they're struggling or anything else, make sure you're filled up with love. You know, that's your power. And that's what works. And that's what teachers do. That's why I love teachers so much, because teachers, their love of knowledge and their love of being able to give that to another human being, that's your the joy, that's when you're fulfilling your human duty, you know. And so I tell everybody this every morning before you wake up, or when you wake, as the minute you wake up, start filling yourself up with love. And that means when you fill out yourself with love, there's no room for distrust or hate or envy or greed or any of those you know emotions that are the opposite of love. And so when you cleanse your soul, and that's what priests and monks try to do, or you know, they try to cleanse their soul and keep their mind free of anything evil or distrusting or anything bad, and the way they do it, they fill it up with love. And so no matter what you're doing, you do that, and then miracles happen. We watched on the golf, we watched it with John Ron. Yeah, he told us, he said, yeah, I knew that I was going to win. And he was so full of love that he couldn't lose. And that's as a father, you know, I'm a great grandfather, you know, and the only thing I really have to give the kids is my love. And you can see little babies. We got little Kira, and she sees me, and right away she leans, she's attracted to me. She just wants to be near me, and she just wants to just be near me. That's all. And that is the secret of life. And so you want to be a good father, be a good husband, and with your marriage, oh my God, that works so well. I'm in a relationship right now with a gorgeous woman that is 10 years my junior, and she looks more like 40 years my junior. She's gorgeous, and she's a handful, and she's opinionated, and she's all these things. And of course, I'm the guy that can't do anything right. You know, that's my job. But she the other day she said, "Why are you smiling?" And I said, "I'm just counting my blessings. That's all." And you can't have humor without love. You know, if you got love, you know, if you want to be funny, I watched Carlin, George Carlin. You know, he got on funny when he lost the love. You know, and he started kind of preaching and started being, you know, comparing other people with other people. You know, and comparing this and that. You know, and you can't do that. But it's love. That's the answer to everything, and it's something that everybody can do. There's no problem with that. Yeah, you can have a lot of memories, and you can cling to them, and you know, that's karma too, you know, because not everybody's going to be walking around like me smiling. But since you asked, and the only reason I'm telling you this is because you asked.
Well, thanks, Tommy, for answering so eloquently. I mean, you are really a philosopher as far as I'm concerned, and that's kind of what this episode has been, was learning about your philosophy of life. But I want to thank you for joining us today on El Niño's, the Tornado Hunters podcast. But I also want to give a shout out before we go to all of our new Patreon members. And we've had a number joining this week, and certainly couldn't do a show like this without support. And that's what we get through Patreon.com. So if you're interested in becoming a patron of the show, check out patreon.com/El Niños, and you can get behind the scenes access. You can get a chance to interact and chat with our guests like Tommy Chong, Amanda Ruler, pro athlete, Paul Brandt, country music singer, Chris Bukowski from the Bachelor TV show. But again, check out patreon.com/El Niños. CameraEasy.ca is our sponsor. For Chris Cubby Chittick, for Ricky Forbes, and for Nick the Body, I'm Greg Johnson, and I want to thank you. We'll tune in with you next go around. Thanks so much, guys.
Hey, everybody, this is Paul Brandt, and you're listening to the El Niños, the Tornado Hunters podcast.
Yawn, man! Whoa!
Good driving, Ricky.
Oh, this vehicle's underneath it.
Oh, it's taking
up power poles.